Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is March 28th, 2019, and this is episode 131. Politicoast is a BC politics podcast. Tell us what you think of the show by leaving us a review or get at us on social media. Most importantly, help us build the show by throwing us a couple bucks a month at patreon.com/politicoast.
I'm Scott Delinebaum.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, ride-hailing, LNG, NDS, more SNC-Lavalin. Politicoast is in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicoast enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate. For your free two-week trial of the newsletter, go to britishcolumbiatoday.ca. First up, ride-hailing a no-no, but LNG is a go-go. I basically wanted to stick these two together because I think they both expose the ongoing contradictions that the NDP lives in its shift from campaigning in opposition to government, where you have to make tough, shitty decisions. And those don't always agree with everything you can say in opposition. The first bit of news is the NDP talked a lot about how they could make ride-hailing happen in like 3 months when they were campaigning. Basically, they said by the end of 2017. And now we're looking at maybe by the end of 2019.
Yeah, they've said it's going to be the end of this year, which, you know, for those keeping track, is 2 years after they said they were going to do it in the first place. And I'm not sure anyone believes they're going to do it this time or that they even want to.
There's a new report out from the All-Party Parliamentary Committee on Ride-Hailing, or Legislative Committee, whatever it's called. They make some new recommendations based on what the government asked them to generate. And already, Minister Claire Trevanna has been out there deep-sixing as many of those recommendations as she can, or at least notably the recommendation that a Class 5 driver's license should be enough to drive an Uber or other ride-hailing option. Class 5 is the standard driver's license most of us have if you do the bare minimum to get a driver's license. The government really wants to go with a Class 4, which is the extra step you have
to... It's the commercial driver's license.
It's the license where you say, I am going to drive people around for money, which in a lot of ways seems like a reasonable thing for ride-hailing people.
That's kind of fit the description of what an Uber driver does.
So that one, I can see where the NDP are coming from. Some of the other recommendations of this report, the minister has said she will be looking at. They include not having boundaries on where ride-hailing cars can go. And I think...
Seems reasonable.
Yeah. Most car trips are going to involve moving from one city to another or going to the airport, and it's
that's nice actually more reasonable than the taxi system, which I believe does have zones, and like you can't necessarily be picked up in a car from Richmond if you're in Vancouver, even if that Richmond taxi has just dropped someone off on a trip into Vancouver.
I guess the hope with the zone system is that you prevent all the cars from just, you know, floating around downtown Vancouver and creating extra congestion there, but to some extent, it does create a lot of empty car trips, so I can see why no boundaries is good. There's some reasonable ones, like vehicles must be newer than 10 years of age. That's, I guess, just a reasonable safety issue. Costs for getting an accessible Uber rideshare should not exceed a non-accessible one, which, again, don't discriminate. And the minimum trip price should not be less than the cost of public transit, which would be difficult to have a trip price that's under, what's the one zone fare, like $250 right now?
Is it?
It's in that
rare area. I've got a monthly pass. I don't actually keep track with the...
I just tap and it auto-loads.
Yeah. Compass card is great.
Presto cards in Ottawa, not great. But that's my trip story.
I could maybe see a case for like super short distances if you're on a couple blocks, but even then...
Yeah.
It would generally, I think, be hard to get a trip under what? $225, $250.
Yeah. I think the most controversial recommendation in here is that there shouldn't be caps on the fleet sizes that any company can have. So essentially, Uber could hire everyone in the city of Vancouver to be a driver. And we just see how that turned out. Probably
That's
bad for
one everyone. Way to phrase that. Not everybody is going to become an Uber driver. And more to the point, this is probably a pretty good recommendation because it creates more competition, which is better for consumers. And one of the big problems with the taxi industry is the artificial taxi cap is part of what makes it A, hard to get a cab in a lot of cases, and B, makes them more expensive than they need be for consumers.
For me, it's just a tragedy, the commons type situation at some point where, yes, a few more options is good. Too many more options starts to eat into everyone's success and puts a lot more cars on the road, creating additional needless congestion. Well, so finding that balance is the challenge.
If you're concerned about cars on the road, put a congestion charge on.
Although I think they often exempt commercial vehicles from those. Or at least taxis and buses.
Which they shouldn't. Buses, maybe.
So I think the NDP are more likely to put more restrictions here, whereas opposition Liberals and Greens on this committee, who don't have to fear the taxi industry right now, are happy to go a little bit more strong and try and push the government to not put caps on there. I wouldn't be surprised to see some artificial scarcity created here, but I think the NDP are still struggling to figure out how to deal with this file. The other bit of news on ride hailing is, even if we don't get Uber or Lyft, and they're evil companies, or at least Uber definitely is, by the end of the year, it looks like we may have one made-in-BC solution. This is Kater, K-A-T-E-R, the ride-hailing app being developed by, I'm pretty sure it's the taxi industry themselves, or like a conglomeration of different taxi companies. And that will roll out here in Vancouver and sort of spread across the Lower Mainland fairly quickly. I did go onto their website to look up what their kind of standards are, and they offer actually pretty good incentives to drivers. They guarantee you, they don't say what it is, but they guarantee you a minimum hourly rate. They cover your insurance and maintenance costs. They will provide a vehicle if you don't want to use your own, which seems like a good idea. And I think if you stick with them for 3 or 6 months, you can get $1,000 cash just straight out, which is all actually pretty tempting. So maybe we'll throw in the towel on this whole podcasting thing and go become Kater drivers. You do have to complete the additional, you know, class 4 license certification and a taxi licensing thing, but you can get those paid back if you stick with them. No clue what it's going to cost or how well it's going to work. I know a few other provinces and cities have tried this approach before, and it's generally sucked. The website of Kater does look like a modern, good website, which is a first encouraging sign. Usually when these kind of alternate either force a group to make it or the government makes it, it kind of comes out really dodgy.
So they've managed not to make the Phoenix of ride-hailing apps.
Correct. Yes. It has not cost a ton of money as far as I know. But it's also not out there yet. So that'll be out soon, and that, I guess, will help the NDP tick their, you know, we promised you ride-hailing
some
pledge.
Point. What's a retcon, couple years?
Yeah, their retconned promise of, yeah, we totally meant eventually, and 2017 was really 2019. It's an odd year. The other promise they're trying to square the circle on is their bill to permit the great LNG boom here in British Columbia is working its way through the legislature. The Green Party demanded a recorded vote on first reading, which is something you do when you want to showboat, because bills almost always go through on first reading. And in this case, it was only the 3 Green MLAs out of the, I think there were 84 people in the room at the time, who voted against this bill going forward. So you had all of the New Democrats and all of the BC Liberals teaming up.
As they finally found out something they can agree on.
Yeah, and I can't imagine how many BC NDP supporters are super happy about this. It's probably split down the middle. About half are happy, half are upset, depending whether they live in Vancouver or up north. The specifics of the deal, the Liberals say they still have qualms about, but it's easy to say that in opposition. It is weird to see the NDP hand out such big subsidies. Like,
what are they, the Alberta NDP?
Yeah. So, like, specifically, they're rolling back income tax charges that Christy Clark had introduced that said, if we're going to have LNG, it should pay some money back to the province. And I think the NDP at the time was critical that it wasn't paying enough. And so those, that, like, special LNG income tax is now gone.
Oh, so the NDP are now tats cutters compared to Christy Clark.
Just for special interests, which I guess she was just taxing a specific interest. It's a really frustrating system because
yeah, they're also giving exemptions to the carbon tax, which defeats the whole purpose of a carbon tax if the biggest polluters don't have to pay it.
I love how many of these things are pitched as make big polluters pay, and then they're just like, but the biggest polluters, no one wants them to pay because jobs. Like, it kind of undermines the entire point of the value of this project when you have to give it so many subsidies to make it economically viable. And then you also have the NDP starting to pick up that, well, at least this will reduce carbon emissions in China if they take our LNG over coal from somewhere else, which was the talking point Clark used that every environmentalist bashed her with. So Andrew Weaver's been having a field day out of this, just going through old Hansard records and giving speeches where he quotes individual New Democrat MLAs who are on the record with essentially the exact opposite position that they have today. And full credit to Weaver for that, because that shit needs to be called out. And that's not to say the NDP was ever anti-LNG. They were always like under the right circumstances, but now the right circumstances seem to be massive handout.
In my opinion, are the wrong circumstances.
Something we agree on. But it looks like this is inevitably going to pass and probably be the most popular by number of MLAs.
40 votes?
Well, yeah, most popular by like number of MLAs voting for it kind of bill, even if the public isn't as supportive.
Yeah, I mean, not the overwhelming support that the Hansard vote will show, but the public in general is supportive of LNG.
Yeah. Actually, I shouldn't say that. I know there have been several unanimous votes of the legislature. The Human Rights Commission was a unanimous vote. The anti-slap law was actually a unanimous vote. And there's probably been a few other, like, those minor statute amendment acts.
But the most popular one that is in some way controversial.
Yeah. The one that divides the Green DP is the one that unites the Grand Coalition, I guess.
Moving on to segment two, few problems are solved by creating more leaks. The SNC story just will not die. So this week started off with a interesting story that both Canadian Press and CTV picked up on.
Well, I think they were given this story.
Yeah, picked up on in the sense that somebody gave them the story here, which was that apparently the relationship between Jody Wilson-Raybould and Justin Trudeau soured over who should replace Beverly McLaughlin on the Supreme Court.
And that's the most of this story that makes sense. Like, the more you dig into this one, the just more bizarre it gets. So I guess Jody Wilson-Raybould had wanted Manitoba Chief Justice Joel to be appointed to the Supreme Court of Canada. That of itself is not too weird, because lots of Chief Justices from Supreme Courts will kind of skip the Court of Appeal and go straight to the Supreme Court. Yeah. And she wrote a 60-page brief arguing for him.
So how the government has set up the selection of the Supreme Court justices is that there's this commission panel. I can't quite recall the exact term, but basically,
the word independent is in there for sure.
Yes. And it is chaired by former Conservative Prime Minister Kim Campbell. So, you know, it's not just a bunch of liberal hacks, although there may be one or two, I'm not sure, on this. But they basically traded a short list. Justice Joel's name was on there, and Jody Wilson-Raybould wanted him to be elevated to the Supreme Court and the Chief Justice role, apparently.
Yes.
And that's the odd part.
That is a very odd part. And as soon as journalists learned that, they started digging through their history books, as they're wont to do. And I think the last time that someone went straight to the position of Chief Justice was like 1905.
Like, and a Laurier appointment or something?
Yeah, it was someone who was totally not a judge, and he's just like, I want my buddy to be Chief Justice. And I guess that's what you did then, but it's not what you do
now. The Liberals have gotten a little less corrupt over the past century.
Or just found different ways to do it. So there were a few things happening around the time Beverly McLaughlin retired. One was Justice Wagner at the time got caught up in a scandal where he, like,
well, it wasn't really a stand. It was a controversy.
A controversy where he didn't permit any LGBT groups to intervene in the TW Law School case, which my group, the Humanist Association, intervened in successfully in the end after he, on Beverly McLaughlin's advice, let everyone in.
Yeah, so a few people had had eyebrows raised over his judgment on that one.
And his subsequent interview with the Globe and Mail, which was
also weird.
So people were wondering about that, but there's a modern-ish custom in Canada for the Supreme Court where you go back and forth between Quebecois judges and English Canada judges to basically reflect the two legal systems of this country, the common law and the civil law. Because Beverly McLaughlin represented English Canada, it was Quebec's turn. And Wagner was the most senior person on the court, so he seemed like the obvious pick, notwithstanding these kind of eruptions. Bringing someone from outside the court in was really weird, but I guess there was a second step to this where Jody Wilson-Raybould wanted to elevate someone to Chief Justice.
Yeah, a Métis individual to the Chief Justice of the Court of Queen's Bench of Manitoba. But I think we're getting a little ahead of ourselves because this was the subsequent leak that revealed that. So we kind of buried the lead a bit here in that the real meat of this story was that Trudeau was apparently aghast at this recommendation because he dug up some speech that Justice Joel had given where he raised some concerns that since the charter was brought in, far too many political issues have been basically moved out of the legislature and into the judicial branch to resolve, and that it's maybe not the best thing for the country's long-term political culture is to basically have politicians punt all the hard questions to the courts.
I mean, that part's not wrong.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like, this is such a milquetoast take on the charter that it's entirely conventional. I'm pretty sure I've said something along those lines at some point or another on this podcast. It's ultimately unremarkable, but apparently this was a line too far for Justin.
I think where it got too far is he suggests maybe a bit more restraint from judges themselves. And being a judge, that's the kind of crowd he was talking to. So that's
it was a Canadian Constitution Foundation. So
yeah, they've been characterized as a right-wing group, and I've come
across
them
a few
times.
They were civil libertarian-esque type.
On the more center-right side, but they're not, the Justice Center for Constitutional Freedoms or some of the more fringy
ones. Yeah, they're
not
going to be, This isn't the taxationist theft crowd.
Yeah. So some of his comments were a bit more conservative in nature, but
Within the mainstream.
Yeah. He's no Scalia.
Yeah.
So Trudeau does not like Joel and decides to go a different way. He appoints Sheila Martin in the end to the Supreme Court of Canada, an Alberta justice.
Yeah, so he appoints her, and this leak is, I think, fairly clearly an attempt to basically suggest that Jody Wilson-Raybould's judgment was flawed, and that she was going to appoint this uber social conservative. That was the take that kind of came out of this, which is a pretty gross mischaracterization of both the former justice minister and Justice Joel.
I think the fact she wanted someone from outside to jump straight to Chief Justice was weird, and the 60-page argument was also a bit weird, but it's not
What is a normal briefing for a Supreme Court?
I don't actually know, because it's supposed to be
confidential.
Entirely confidential. This is cabinet confidence level stuff. The stuff Jody Wilson-Raybould is going way out of her way to uphold, which makes the leak that much more ironic and hilarious. Because apparently the PMO, because that's the only other place this could have come from reasonably.
Yeah, and that's the thing. This is a pretty transparent attempt by the PMO to smear Jody Wilson-Raybould, and it backfired badly. Basically, nobody agreed with the characterization that was put out on this. And everybody who wasn't a hardcore liberal partisan roundly condemned it. Including the Manitoba Bar Association, the Canadian Bar Association.
Justice Joel
himself had some very strong words on it.
Yeah, when your name gets leaked out here, you just have to be please don't bring me into this.
Well, not only please don't bring me into this, it was my candidacy is being used for, he might have even used the word nefarious purposes, I'm trying to find. Basically asserting it's being used to further someone's agenda. So overall, this was like a bad moment that reflected badly on the Prime Minister and his staff. And it really just automates you wonder, like, is there anyone thinking at all in the Prime Minister's office about how to handle this? Because the let's stop talking about SNC doesn't really work if you keep making the situation worse and keep people talking about it.
Yeah, this is a masterclass in bad communications. This is what not to do at every level.
Mm-hmm. And also concerned here is this potentially politicizes the appointments of Supreme Court justices in a very unhelpful way. Like, we've been pretty fortunate not to go down the path that the American Supreme Court has done, but the Prime Minister has such a narrow ideological view of what's an appropriate position for a Supreme Court justice to hold. That's concerning. And then the fact that this would get aired publicly is also concerning and, you know, definitely raises questions. Like, if, you know, Andrew Scheer becomes Prime Minister, which the polls apparently are saying is the most likely outcome, now that there's apparently a precedent here for considering that sort of thing, you know, what's to stop him from appointing someone who's much more natively partisan?
Well, and the fact you can apparently leak from these conversations without any consequences means...
Well, unless you're an admiral.
Well, it means everyone's going to think twice before giving their full and frank assessment of the situation. Because the reason you have confidence in many of these things is because sometimes you want to be able to give an opinion that is probably closer to the truth, but wouldn't be politically astute or useful to say publicly, like talking about someone's controversial opinions just to at least air all sides of it. This is why things are done in closed door meetings, because you can have these conversations, get things out there, come to a decision, and then everyone can feel better about that decision.
Yeah, well, is the next time a Supreme Court vacancy is reopened, will the justice minister actually be willing to give their honest assessment of the candidates now that there's a potential that could be leaked?
Well, now that David Lametti is in there and everyone seems to be thinking he's kind of the yes man put in to fill the shoes after Jody Wilson-Raybould was too independent-minded, let's say, maybe he won't, but puts him in a difficult place.
Yeah, and the only other thing I'll say on this is I think it really just goes to show how badly the Liberals thought this through, and that the underlying controversy in the whole SNC thing is the lack of respect from the Prime Minister's office to the independent functioning of the justice system. And to then bring in a judge into it out of the blue just really reinforces that underlying narrative.
Well, this also raises a lot of questions about ethics in government. But one place they won't be discussing the ethics of this situation is the Parliamentary Ethics Committee, which would seem like a reasonable place to go. But according to liberals on that committee, the Justice Committee has heard all they need to hear. And why would they open any further investigation into this at this point?
Well, the Justice Committee hasn't heard all it needs to hear, as evidenced by the fact that there are more submissions coming. Well, actually, I believe they were submitted earlier this week.
Yeah, they're going to be out tomorrow by the time this is online from Jody Wilson-Raybould, who has sent in all of her emails and texts and other documentary records, and I think an extra statement.
Yeah, I believe there's a statement coming in that basically addresses the disagreements between her testimony and that of Jerry Butts.
So that's a lot more to come. I feel bad for Nathaniel Erskine-Smith, who was, I think, the deputy chair of the ethics committee who the liberals put out there to try to defend the decision not to investigate the situation, because Erskine-Smith is someone who's generated a wide amount of trust and respect because he tends to be pretty independent minded and willing to speak out on issues that he's passionate about and is a generally smart guy. And so to see him try to walk this line of like playing the liberal hack but also trying to maintain some of that integrity is just sad. And you'd almost hope he'd like call in sick that day to at least try to bow out of having to play this part. But, you know, politics can be a dirty sport. Well, and if things are tough for Nathaniel Erskine-Smith, things got a bit tougher, weirder over at SNC-Lavalin this past week, as after we said last week that the CEO had dismissed the idea that the 9,000 jobs number came from his company, they kind of walked that back a little bit and said, all right, it wasn't 9,000, but we were talking with the government about splitting the company up, sending most of the jobs to the states, and otherwise trying to tank the Quebec economy if we didn't get this DPA, which does play into Trudeau's jobs, jobs, jobs line.
Yeah, now it doesn't help in the sense that the prime minister shouldn't be interfering with a judicial proceeding. That doesn't help at all. But yeah, it does add a little more clarity on where he was taking his margin orders from, I guess.
The fact SNC can't even keep its story straight is not great either. But I guess they weren't expecting to have to make public statements on the wheeling and dealing they were doing behind the scenes with the head of the government.
And finally, as we hinted at a bit earlier in this, there's more polling coming out that is showing this scandal has taken its toll on Trudeau. It's an Ipsos poll conducted for Global News that found that Trudeau's approval rating slipped to 40%, which is highlighted as lower than Trump's.
Which I think Trudeau has fewer people negative about him than Trump does. There are probably a lot more fence sitters with Trudeau, but Trump has gone much lower. He's just at a weird, like, quasi-high point. So that comparison was weird.
So yeah, that's a bit of an odd comparison, but I think more importantly is the kind of top line numbers for where the parties sit, which currently, according to this poll, has the Conservatives at 40%, Liberals at 30%, NDP at 21%, and Bloc at 5%.
And this is where you start getting into the realm of, do the Liberals start tanking really fast, and where does their support go?
I don't know if they're going to start tanking fast. I don't think you're going to see a repeat of 2011 where the NDP surpassed the Liberals and the Liberals aren't government or official opposition for like the second time ever. But what it does is it gives Trudeau a long way to climb back up before the next election. And Dave Moskrop mentioned on the podcast last week, you know, he thinks it's going to go away and that it's hard to maintain this kind of throughout the next 7 months until the election, basically between now and October. And that may be the case. I mean, there's also the potential Norman trial that could blow up in a big way and has similarities, SNC-Lavalin scandal. But more importantly, it just takes a while to kind of regain that ground. And if you're starting 10 points behind, it's tough.
And more importantly than the 10 points behind thing, I think, is the trend line, which is in the wrong direction for the Liberals and in a very good direction for Scheer. Notably not on that poll is the People's Party, which I think...
Categorized in the others at 4%.
Which is probably...
All the others are at 4%.
Are the Greens fit in there as well, or are they...
They are also part of that 4% other.
So that 4% other that includes People's Party and Greens is actually surprisingly low, because the Greens have pulled 5, 6% in some of the last elections. And given the mood in BC with them as a solid third party, with the Greens sitting weirdly like in first place, possible majority territory in PEI.
Yeah. Well, also, like, we should point out that we're reading this off the Global website, and they were the ones who commissioned the poll. The story doesn't actually contain what the breakdown, you know, what the question was asked or what the crosstabs were. They may have only listed those parties and just gave other as the other one, which isn't great polling, but, you know, that does have a tendency to lower the ones that are listed as other.
Fair enough. Good point.
Yeah. PEI actually looks like the Greens are most likely to form government or have a really good shot at it.
And neither of us understand PEI politics at all.
None of us understand PEI politics. But looking at like the broader picture of just more than one polls, pulling up the CBC poll tracker here, yeah, their aggregate numbers have the Conservatives at 36 to the Liberals 31. So a little tighter, but when you actually look at seat projections, there's a 41% chance of a Conservative majority and a 32% chance of a Conservative minority. The Liberals, they're have 20% chance of forming a minority government and 6% of getting a majority based on the current aggregate of polling, which is bad. Like, a year or two ago, we were speculating, what is the chances that Trudeau could be one of the first prime ministers in Canadian history not to win re-election on his first term? And this might actually do it.
Don't forget that Andrew Scheer can still snag defeat from the jaws of victory here. Like, there's...
Oh, yeah.
The conservative movement's not doing great.
They're not doing great, and they don't really have much of a strategic vision beyond trying to convince people the liberals suck, which is not really much of a strategy. But if the liberals keep fumbling the ball at every opportunity, might be enough. I don't know, at this point, I'm just hoping whatever the outcome is, it's a minority government, because, yeah, this majority hasn't worked out all that well.
And minorities are fun to cover, as we know here in
D.C. Also that, too.
Well, let's move into quick takes, where we can start off by talking about a few more polls. There are a couple provincial polls out that are kind of interesting. First up, Angus Reid looked across the country at how popular is every premier, and for whatever reason, Saskatchewan gets a premier, and they're in love with him for as long as he's around, and it's always been men. And so Scott Moe is the second most popular premier in the country after François Legault, who has a 60% approval rating.
Must be the post-election honeymoon.
Yeah, that's like a shocking one, because
he didn't get 60%.
He didn't get anywhere near 60%, so I guess a lot of the Liberals are liking him, a lot of the Parti Québécois. I can't imagine Quebec Solidaire voters are loving him, but all right, so he's popular. I think Scott McNeil was ranked the least popular premier. John Horgan did not too bad. He scored just over 50%, I believe, on this poll, which is up a little bit from the last time they did this ranking. And our neighbor, Rachel Notley, was also doing solidly, but not quite in. So yeah, John Horgan's the third most popular premier with 52%. Rachel Notley has 40%. Doug Ford has 38% still. He can do a little bit better, people. He's still kind of, he can do a little bit better. The premier of PEI is not actually listed on the poll, probably because Angus Reid does not have enough people in PEI to call to ask what they think of their premier. That's legitimately probably it. And also they're going to an election. So those are pretty decent numbers for John Horgan. Although I'm still not convinced how tightly approval ratings of the premier tie to their election fortunes. Obviously, if you're at 24%, like McNeil here, your party's probably going to lose. And if you're at 60%, you could probably go to the election and be fine. But
when was, I think we were bottomed out around 11 at one point or something. And that definitely did not help her chance at re-election.
Like, yeah, on the broad strokes, being higher is better. But when you're in that middle range, you could be between like 30 and 55%. And
yeah, I don't think we can really tell much from New Brunswick Premier Higgs's approval ratings on what his chances of re-election are. He has 49% for the record.
One poll that might be a bit more useful is Main Street released its latest horse race poll here in British Columbia that shows a gap widening between the NDP and the BC Liberals. But I don't give Main Street a lot of credit these days because they continue to include the BC Conservatives in their polls, who are sitting at 12% in the province, compared to the BC Greens' 13%.
That would be the best conservative result in a long time here.
Like, the conservatives don't run a full slate. They reported, weirdly, the net approval minus disapproval rating, which is fine for each of the leaders. But they tried to show that, I think it's Steve Anderson, the leader of the interim leader of the conservatives, is like has a higher net approval rating than some of the other party leaders.
That's probably because nobody knows who he is, so they don't know to hate him yet.
Yeah. If your unknown is like 90% and like eight people say, yeah, he seems like a good guy, and two say, no, I don't like him, you have a plus six, which looks great compared to some of the other leaders, but it doesn't mean anything because no one cares who you are. Meanwhile, Weaver, Horgan, and Wilkinson are all in the spotlight. Horgan has a pretty decent number there. Wilkinson's doing not great, as you'd expect. And I think Weaver was in the middle. I don't remember exactly. But I just really wanted to bring up the Main Street poll to shit on them for polling what people think of the BC Conservatives still, when they have no presence in this province.
Well, except to act as the occasional spoiler.
Or joke for us.
Yes. They have fixed their website.
Yes.
In other news, Trudeau has called the Nanaimo Ladysmith by-election. This was the one that was opened up after Sheila Melkinson stepped down to run for MLA. That will be on May 6th. It's a by-election. It'll probably be an NDP hold. I the Liberals being the mess that they are right now, I can't see them picking it up. It'd be pretty damn unlikely for the Conservatives or Greens to do so.
So 2015, Nanaimo Ladysmith was actually pretty interesting because it was almost a four-way race. Like, the NDP won it with a solid 10 points, but it was only with 33% of the vote. It was because the Liberals and Conservatives almost exactly tied at 23%, and then the Greens sat down there with just under 20%. The Greens are running the same candidate, Paul Manley, again, and I'm assuming he'll hope to hold as many of those votes because, like I try to say every time we talk about a by-election, it's not about finding new voters. It's just like, get the voters you had at the federal election and you can win. The Liberals are running on Michelle Corfield, Conservatives are running John Hurst, and the People's Party are running Jennifer Clark. And that name sounds familiar because I think she may have been one of their candidates before or was one of those like anti-Soji school board candidates. The NDP doesn't actually have a candidate yet. They are having their nomination meeting this Saturday. Their candidates include Lauren Semple, Chief Bob Chamberlain, Fred Statham, and Maeve O'Byrne. The only name I know in that list is Bob Chamberlain because he's been involved with the, I believe it's the Union of BC Indian Chiefs, but he may have been involved, or it might be a different lobby group, but he's fairly prominent for speaking out on Indigenous issues and would probably be a pretty good candidate for them. So my prediction is Chamberlain wins that, but I don't know the internal goings-on in the Nanaimo Ladysmith NDP, so it could be any of them. Given the closeness of 2015 in the riding and the fact the NDP is not running a incumbent and are down in the polls overall, it could be anyone's game, except the Marxist-Leninist who only got 0.2%. Sorry, comrades, you're not going to take Nanaimo this time.
Or probably ever.
Or probably ever, at least not at the polls. The Liberals, like you say, are faltering in BC, both because of the SNC-Lavalin ongoing scandal, but also because I think Nanaimo Ladysmith is the kind of voter who would not be very happy with the Trans Mountain Pipeline purchase and some of that. And those people who are would probably just go over to the Conservatives. So maybe it'll be a three-way race with the Liberals falling out, and we'll see who comes out there. So it will be kind of interesting to win, but it'll also be pretty pointless since whoever wins will have to face off probably against the exact same candidates in October.
Yeah, I guess it's time to work out all the kinks before the main event.
Yeah, I did see someone asking somewhere, I think it was on one of the Slacks I'm in, about whether it's necessary to hold an election in a riding right so close after a by-election has been held, and the answer is yes.
Yeah, the House is dissolved. There is no parliament for that person to be in once the writ has been issued.
Yeah, a general election is all
it just wipes the slate clean.
And it feels really dumb, and it feels like you should get a, you know, I've only been here like 3 months. Come on. Like, I only got sworn in for like 2 weeks of sitting, if that. What usually happens with these by-elections, I think what everyone was expecting to happen, was this to get drawn out. Like, it would be a very long by-election that would just become the general election, and so there would never be a by-election.
Yeah, it didn't have to be called for another couple months.
So why did Trudeau call it? Is it another attempt to change the channel?
Maybe. I mean, at this point, they seem to be trying everything.
Everything except contrition. One place the Liberals are hoping to get a little bit more good news, though, is over in Vancouver Kingsway, where this past week Trudeau was in town for the nomination meeting to, I'm pretty sure it was an acclamation, of former...
I wonder if it might have been contested.
May have been contested, but she won it pretty easily. Tamara Taggart, the former TV news host here in Vancouver, who was fairly popular and has been very active on social media since then. She was involved in a fight over lead in Vancouver schools. And, you know, it's honestly a really good get for Trudeau. And she's hoping to pick the riding up.
Yeah, this is clearly like a play where she's a star candidate that's being recruited for this, and that they want to pick the riding up.
From Don Davies from the NDP.
Yeah, but Don Davies is a fairly popular MP. He's a pretty good constituency MP. And Vancouver Kingsway is a pretty orange place in the Lower Mainland. Like, it's, if I was, you know, looking at a map of Vancouver, it wouldn't necessarily, or Southern BC, it wouldn't necessarily be the riding I'd be looking to pick up if I was the Liberals.
Davies got 47% of the vote in the last federal election.
Yeah, that's going to be tough to beat.
So yeah, the Taggart v. Davies fight will be interesting, but again, really hard to see Don Davies losing. Which is kind of sad.
It would be a pretty big upset.
I would like to see Tamara Taggart, do more. She's interesting to me, and I find her, passion for these issues inspiring, and maybe she'd make a good federal politician, but we won't know until she tries. And
East Vancouver is not a particularly friendly spot to be trying that.
At least as a Liberal.
Yeah. Well, pretty much anyone but a New Democrat. One thing that isn't going to help the Liberals win new seats or even hold on to the ones they currently have is another controversy surrounding Justin Trudeau. So earlier this week, he was attending a fundraiser in Toronto when there was a protest by Indigenous persons from the Grassy Narrows First Nations. And for those unfamiliar, this is a First Nations community that has been dealing with the effects of industrial pollution and very unsafe mercury levels, both in their water and in the local fisheries and environment there. And this has been an ongoing issue for years, and there hasn't been much action from the federal government or the Ontario provincial government on this. And they staged a protest at this fundraiser, and Trudeau did not respond very well to it.
Yeah, so the people bought $1,500 tickets to go to the Laurier Club event where he would be at to display their banner.
The Laurier Club is the club the Liberals have for large donors.
So they attend and are starting to make some noise. And Trudeau, in his let's shut things down a little cheekily kind of way, says, "Thank you very much for your donation tonight. I really appreciate the donation to the Liberal Party of Canada."
The video is actually worse than you make it sound.
Great. Of course it is. Because he does a surprising amount of patronizing things to Indigenous people.
Oh, it's incredibly condescending. Yeah, it's incredibly condescending. He did finally apologize today, but between SNC and this, it's almost like the Liberals are systematically trying to dismantle the brand they built in 2015. Or they highlighted reconciliation,
feminism,
and I don't think we mentioned it, but these were women protesting too. So just overall, not a great moment. And when that kind of, cuts into the heart of the Trudeau brand.
And the situation Grassy Narrows is tragic and it's bad. And it's something that's a national tragedy that we should have been dealing with. And these are ridiculous comments and really starts to build a narrative and a trend, especially when you talk or think about the Selena Caesar Chavanas story where she reports being rudely dismissed by Trudeau, that he just can't deal with protest or he can't deal with disagreement in a healthy way. And that's not great when you're prime minister of the country. But let's come back to British Columbia for another story. I think a few weeks ago we talked about the federal government giving money to homeopaths abroad. That's not their exact name, but to their purpose was basically
homeopaths without borders.
Yeah, something like that.
Anyway, a bunch of quacks.
CBC has now looked into this with local reporter Bethany Lindsay, who's done a ton of fantastic coverage on pseudoscience. She looked into some of the gaming grants that come out. This is the casino revenues from this province that go to charities and nonprofits who apply and fund a lot of
money laundering's funding.
Yeah. Well, it's like when I talked to the BC Civil Liberties Association and all the forfeiture money, well, some of the forfeiture money is going to crime reduction and charities. It's a great scam. But the casino money is generally not ill. Well, some of it's not ill-gotten. That's not
much
the question.
Much of it is not ill-gotten. But it's more what it's being spent on. That's the concern here.
So it seems that every year for a number of years, a group called the Health Action Network Society has been getting $40,000 from the BC government, which since 2007 has totaled $428,500. And this group describes itself as concerned with vaccine safety. And anyone who works in immunology pretty quickly realizes that's a code for we don't like vaccines. We think they're all a government scam. Let's ask some questions. and talk sciencey, but really just try to dissuade people from life-saving preventative medicine.
Yeah, it's what the anti-vaccine movement brands themselves as to avoid seeming completely nuts.
And so the BC government, over a number of years, again spanning multiple administrations, is throwing money at something rather dodgy. They have promised a review of this now that the minister's been made aware, because the way a lot of these granting systems work is bureaucrats at some mid-level are tasked with approving or denying them, and it just kind of goes from there. And once you've gotten one gaming grant, you kind of know how those really long, complicated forms work, and you can probably get it year after year.
Health Action Network Society, according to the CBC, also advocates for wider use of homeopathy. Again, not great. Campaign for labeling genetically modified foods. There's a little bit of dodgy stuff there, potentially. And pushes for more action on climate change, which, I mean, I guess broken clots being right and everything's fine. But yeah, overall, maybe not the best group to be giving money to, especially because the president of the board wrote a anti-vaccine book where the back cover, and I'm quoting here, says, "We've been done, I dare say, indoctrinated into the belief that vaccines are safe and effective." So well outside the scientific consensus.
Yeah, they showcased the movie Vaxxed, which is a documentary linking MMR to autism. They were banned from Pinterest for spreading pseudoscience, which, cool, people are still on Pinterest. Yeah, hopefully this is a quick and easy don't give the money again and save the, or spend that $40,000 on any other number of deserving charities, because I know there are lots that apply for gaming grants.
Yeah, kind of related to that, there's another story I found this week from Toronto where an arbitrator settled a dispute between two parents over whether or not to vaccinate their child in what is probably the worst possible way. So the disagreement between the parents, father wanted the kids vaccinated, mother didn't, ended up in arbitration and sided with the mother in this case. Citing some kind of unfortunate stuff where he said, "I'm unable to find a risk to the children that if they remain unvaccinated," which, as the measles outbreak here has shown, is categorically false. And further, that he was satisfied that on the evidence that vaccines may pose additional risk and harm to them. So not great that binding arbitration is being done on such shoddy scientific grounds. And even worse, ordering the father to pay for the legal fees of both parties in this, which is kind of a slap in the face to the quite reasonable parental desire to ensure kids don't get infectious diseases.
One of the big criticisms of administrative tribunals and administrative law in this country and how much deference they're being given is these people aren't
they don't have the
adjudicators. Yeah, they're not the same expert level as judges, and
even judges don't have the scientific training all necessary to really evaluate this.
Yeah, the key, though, that I would hope, but I know this isn't true, is that at a certain level you start to understand, oh, this is a good expert, this is a bad expert, or at least I need to hear from another expert or discount this expert. But to do that all effectively requires a lot of money to be able to have good lawyers who can argue cases. Point being, at a low adjudication level, binding arbitration level, relying on this, like, doing the science is hard at the best of cases. Now, in this case, it shouldn't have been. You can Google what, like, Health Canada says about vaccines. That seems reasonable for an adjudicator to do, or have someone do for them, not just having some person with random credentials arguing a seemingly scientific case for one of the sides. Just be a little skeptical. Hopefully there's a way that this can be appealed or reviewed and come to a more just conclusion.
I was going to say reality-based, but just works as well.
Either of those. Both of those, ideally. But finally, speaking of injustices, let's talk about arbitrary dress codes in the BC legislature and how that became the most unexpected scandal for the speaker to weigh in on.
Controversy. This week. I think controversy.
Yeah, controversy. I keep overusing the word scandal tonight. It's another controversy. It's a dust-up. It's a kerfuffle.
A brouhaha.
Someone in the Sergeant-at-Arms office, I guess, had said to a female legislative employee, oh, maybe you're showing a little too much skin there. Maybe not those exact words, but that kind of conservative implication, small c conservative. And that was followed by other reports of similar dress code violation reports. And this led to a one-day protest, or at least it's started as one day, and we'll see how long it goes or where this goes from here, with MLAs, journalists, staff members, and all kinds of other women in the legislature deciding to go in short sleeves today to protest this and post some awesome Twitter pictures of them standing in solidarity together against patriarchal dress codes that are keeping them down. And this elevated to the level where Speaker Daryl Plekis decided to weigh in, saying, we don't have a gendered dress code, but if you are gendered, here's some dress codes based on your gender.
Which is weird and makes no sense.
He could have not said anything. I guess he is in charge of the legislature itself, but...
Yeah, if you don't say you have a gender-neutral dress code, actually have a gender-neutral dress code. If you have to create subcategories based on gender, it's not a gender-neutral dress code.
I do give him credit for saying, like, if you identify as a man, here's, like, male dress. And so it was a little bit progressive in that way and, like, recognizing that aspect of gender. But that's kind of, like, forgotten or unnecessary from the broader point of just tell people to be professional.
Yeah, I think there's two issues here that are kind of overlapping, and I think it's probably worth separating them. There's the should there be gender dress expectations question, and then there's the what level of formality does this space require in terms of dress? And for that first question, the answer obviously should be there shouldn't be gender dress expectations. The second one, yeah, I think that's worth debate. So I actually tried to find legislature's dress code online, couldn't find it. Apparently, some of the reporters were asking for a copy of it earlier and have yet to be given one. So that's just an interesting little tidbit to this. But so, like, the only text we have is the speaker's letter, basically, at the moment. And it just says contemporary business attire. But, you know, that's a little vague. And, you know, that can range from casual, you know, khakis and a collared shirt to, you know, suit and tie. If you don't specify whatever it is, you know, there's quite reasonable disagreements happening. So, like, I think you could quite reasonably say, okay, everybody has to wear a jacket. It just is a gender neutral, everybody wears a jacket. That's the level of dress. You know, it's on the formal end of business attire, but we're just setting a common standard. It's the business, whatever that means. And then you're going to quite reasonably have disagreements.
So you're telling me the dress code or uniform of the legislature does not involve a specific suit from a London gift shop expense to the legislature itself?
I don't believe it does.
Funny how all of Plekis's scandals and dust-ups can involve clothing. A lot of credit goes to BC Today reporter and friend of the show and repeated past guests and undoubtedly future guest Shannon Waters, who's been tweeting about this not nonstop today, but pointing it out. I think she also took flack earlier this week as someone talked about the kid in the legislature or the young one. And so there were other journalists like showing their action figures or something.
Oh, I think someone made a comment about the juveniles in the legislature.
Right. So she's owning both of those badges as the unprofessional juvenile, showcasing her, I think it's purple hair right now. Sorry, Shannon, if I got that wrong. Follow her at So Bitter So Sweet. She's got some hot takes on what you should or shouldn't wear in the BC legislature.
And that has been Politicos. Find links to everything we talked about at politicos.ca. If you're a first-time listener, make sure to subscribe and let us know what you think. Support the show and get access to an exclusive Slack channel at patreon.com/politicos. If you have ideas for the show, feel free to send to us. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Shoshana Plotnikoff. Thanks for listening.